This weekend, Republican activists will come together in Duluth to make a number of endorsements, selecting folks who they believe would be best positioned to not only win general elections, but also govern in the offices to which they aspire. This is your Convention Week interview blitz on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We're streaming on TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. You can also catch us through your mobile device and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. Catch up on past shows and interviews, such as the one we're about to have with gubernatorial candidate Jeff Johnson, by doing a search for Closing Argument in your iHeartRadio app. And our channel will pop right up. 651-989-5855 if you have questions or comments for Jeff Johnson, our guest on the phone who we're bringing on now. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Hey, Walter, how are you?
Doing great. And just so the folks know, you'll have to forgive my familiarity. I have known Jeff for many years, and so he's Jeff to me. I hope you are okay with that as well, Mr.
Yeah,
Johnson.
No, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. Thank you.
So the first question out of the gate is, can you give us an update on how the campaign is going and what you're anticipating going into this very important milestone of the state party convention on the weekend?
Yeah, well, it's going very well. I feel very positive about the convention, although, you know, I will try. Some people say, oh, this one's all wrapped up, and that always just scares me because that's exactly how you lose these things.
Right.
And it's not. I mean, everybody walks into that convention a free agent and gets to vote in a secret ballot. So it doesn't matter how many people tell me they're going to vote for me. I actually have to get them to do it, show right. up, and then do it there.
Right.
So I feel good about our count, but there are still, I would say, at least a third of the delegates, if not maybe a little more, are undecided or unidentified. So anything could happen there. I feel like we have some momentum and, you know, we put in a lot of work, and hopefully I will be endorsed, but you just never know.
So I want to get into the particulars of your platform, what it is that you're seeking to do if elected to be the next governor of the state of Minnesota. But before we do that, I'd be remiss to not address the elephant in the room, so to speak, which is the effect upon the convention of Tim Pawlenty announcing not only that he was going to enter the race, but that he was going to skip the convention and go straight to a primary. What factor or what effect has that had in terms of the folks you've been talking to? I know you've been on the phone with delegates and alternates, no doubt.
Yep.
In terms of their enthusiasm and their desire to commit to a particular candidate, in this case, you, what have been your observations as a result of that?
You know, it's interesting because it's been kind of a mix. There are some who have said, you know, oh, he's not even going to show up now, and we think, Jeff, you've got it pretty much wrapped up, and why would we spend the money and the weekend and all this?
Right.
Which, again, is I hate hearing that because it's never the case. And there are others who it actually has energized more. I mean, when Tim got in the race and made it pretty clear that he probably wasn't going to go, well, he was going to go for the primary no matter what, we had a lot of new grassroots activist type Republicans get involved in the campaign and start showing up to volunteer. And that was a positive for my campaign. And then when he announced that he wasn't even going to ask for the endorsement, we saw kind of another uptick of people, some because they were mad and others just because they were, you know, it made the whole thing real to them. And maybe it's time to start, you know, be all in on this. We saw more activity. So it has been, overall, I think that has been positive for my campaign. I think it's a terrible strategy on his part. I don't think it's positive for us as a party. But I think turnout's going to be fine. There will be some who don't show up because of that, but I think there'll be plenty of alternates to fill their spots. So I think we'll have a full house.
JeffForGovernor.com is the website to learn more about the campaign of Jeff Johnson.
JohnsonForGovernor.org, actually. Oh,
I apologize. JohnsonForGovernor.org. I don't know where I got that other one from. JohnsonForGovernor.org to learn more about Jeff Johnson's campaign for the gubernatorial endorsement from the Republican Party. That's going to come to a head this weekend. We'll come out of the convention knowing who the Republican Party endorsed candidate is. There has been some talk of potentially steering towards a non-endorsement. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that have you seen any movement in the direction of, well, maybe we'd be better off just having a four person? I don't know if there's more than four, but the four that I know of, right, in a primary.
Yeah, I don't hear much. Well, I hear that from some people who aren't delegates or alternates. There's a handful of folks who say that, but that's because they're supporting Tim, and that's right, probably the best strategy for him. But I don't worry much at all about a no endorsement. People are going to go up to Duluth. They're going to spend hundreds of dollars. This is the culmination of something they've been working on for many months. And they're not going to want to leave there deadlocked or voting for a no endorsement. So that piece, I'm not too concerned about that one. And I know that there's, as is always the case, there's lots of political machinations going on behind the scenes of, well, maybe Tim's people should vote for this candidate or that candidate to see if they can block something.
Right.
But in the end, I think the delegates are going to say, we want to leave here with an endorsement, and somebody's going to get the 60%. I hope it's me.
All right. So, yeah, enough with the Pawlenty drama and the convention inside baseball. I'm interested in learning what Jeff Johnson looks like as governor of the state of Minnesota. We have a article here from the Star Tribune from today. Governor Mark Dayton signed off Wednesday on nearly $1.5 billion for aging roads, bridges, and other state infrastructure, saying the importance of keeping up public assets outweighed his qualms about which projects made the cut. Now, the obvious question here is, then why did you veto it? Because it's not like the bill changed. What do you make of this end of session drama that we've seen from the governor's office?
It has become commonplace, unfortunately. Every session seems to end in chaos. Mm-hmm. And part of that is the fact that we have just a totally unpredictable governor who is not a leader at all. I call him the toddler in chief because he throws a temper tantrum and, vetoes something and then doesn't really give a reason for why. So it's just frustrating to me. And so part of that is the fact that he's just a really poor leader. There's also a bigger problem there, though. And I think we have come to accept, regardless of party, a legislative process that is really broken. Mm-hmm. When we are ending up with one big, huge garbage omnibus bill that they shove everything into, that is so wrong. In my opinion, it's clearly unconstitutional. But even setting that aside, it's just a terrible way to run government. The fact that every session ends the same way with a few people behind closed doors in the middle of the night making deals, and then legislators not even knowing for sure what they're voting on, and certainly the public not knowing, that has to change. And part of that comes, I think a large part of that comes through the leadership of a governor who said, we're just not going to run government this way anymore. Yeah. And that would be my intent. And, that can be a bipartisan thing, because I think there is frustration just across the board with the citizens and, frankly, a lot of legislators with the way this has been going lately.
Yeah. Well, it's very refreshing to not only hear that sentiment, because it's a fairly common sentiment amongst the circles that we travel in, but with the specificity that you offer in terms of, this is what I would do as governor of the state of Minnesota, make sure that doesn't continue to happen, that something fundamental changes, because I believe you're absolutely right. The fact that as described in the Star Tribune and other sources, the overwhelming majority of the work done this session came down to two bills is utterly absurd, just absolutely inexcusable.
Well, and I complain a lot about the fact that spending just increases by leaps and bounds every year. And at best, as Republicans, we're slowing it down rather than actually stopping it or reducing it. Part of that is these huge omnibus bills, because you get all kinds of spending that would never, ever pass on its own.
Right.
But it's in with these goodies that people feel like they have to have, or
right.
It's in with really good spending, because there is some.
Right.
And so we just keep growing and growing and growing. And I have said on the record in media that I'm going to let the legislature know, regardless of which party controls it, that I am going to veto any omnibus bill that I believe doesn't comply with the single subject clause. I think it's Article 4, Section 17 of the Minnesota Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also not going to sign any bills that haven't been posted for at least 48 hours before debate on them begins, so that the public can actually know what's in them, which will really change the end of session. And I think it will force both the governor and the legislature to get some of this work done a little bit earlier.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. If they have that bottleneck of having to get past the veto pin, that's definitely going to force some change. I'm interested, you know, as a sitting city council member myself, in how tightly you interpret the single subject clause of the Minnesota Constitution. Because, for instance, when we consider bonding, would you consider signing a bonding bill? You know, if we had several bonding bills instead of just the one, would you consider taking a look at one that dealt specifically with, say, water treatment plants? Or, you know, how specific does it have to get in order for you to consider it single subject?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even opposed to, you know, a blanket of opposition to omnibus bills. I think that there are certain areas of spending where things fit well together.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the example you gave of, you know, if you're going to bond for like projects, I think that those fit together, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. And I think that comports with what the Constitution requires.
Yeah.
Just when we start, I mean, you can take the easy stuff out, which is policy should never be in a bonding bill,
right.
In an omnibus bill, period. But then we're also, you know, we have, even when I was in the legislature, which is 12, 14 years ago now, the omnibus bills went a bit too far, in that our public safety omnibus spending bill had some things in it that were pretty marginally attached to public safety. But now there's just no pretense at all anymore.
JohnsonForGovernor.org is the website. Jeff Johnson on the line, seeking the Republican endorsement for governor running this year. When we come back, we'll take your calls for Jeff Johnson and continue to make our way through his action plan available at the website. Very impressive, by the way, the list of issues and the detail offered in your action plan. It's of the websites that I've been looking at this week as we've been, you know, leading up and having different interviews with candidates for a variety of offices. To date, this is the most detailed plan that I've seen on a website. So kudos for that.
Thank you.
651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Jim Neuberger spending time in our illustrious green room preparing for his stint here on the program this evening. He, of course, is seeking the Republican endorsement for U.S. Senate. Before we get to him, though, we still have Jeff Johnson on the line, who is going to be at the convention of the Republican Party of Minnesota this weekend in Duluth, seeking the party's endorsement to run for governor. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. So, Jeff, you know, I think it's no accident, as I look through your website here, johnsonforgovernor.org, and I look at the action plan, that the top thing on the list is government reform. It occurs to me that that was intentional, because from that fountain flows the rest of the stuff, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't believe we can solve the really specific political issue problems that we have in the state, like our taxes are too high and we're overregulated and there are enough health insurance options in greater Minnesota. All of those issues, I don't think we can solve them in any long-term way unless we actually change our system, and more broadly than that, change the culture in government, in our state agencies, because we'll make these changes maybe lower taxes, maybe cut spending, maybe, you know, limit some of the regulations on health insurance options.
Right.
But when the Democrats take over, and they will, because it's how it works in Minnesota, we go back and forth, they'll just change it all back. And that's what we saw after 8 years of Tim Pawlenty. He did some good things, but within a year, they were all gone because nothing structural was changed, and none of the people in government moved. Other than the handful of political appointees at the top of each agency. And so I just really believe that the legislative / governmental reform, fundamental changes have to happen, or, you know, we're just kind of making some changes for a while, but everything flips back in 4 or 8 years.
Yeah, it's the difference between trimming weeds above the soil and pulling them out by the root.
I mean, you're really looking to use that. That's perfect.
Go right ahead. I fully offer that for your use. So you talked a little bit last segment about vetoing omnibus, what you call garbage bills, and I believe that's an accurate characterization. You also talked about the regulatory power to a certain extent. Another thing you have listed on top here is term limits. I'm interested in what your thoughts are on the need, in your view, to impose term limits.
You know, I have always been a term limits guy, and I have imposed my own term limits. I did 3 terms in the House, and that was what I said I would do. And I'm in my 3rd and final term on the county board. So regardless of what happens with this race, I will I'll be done after this term. And I am just a very strong believer from serving in both of those areas that there is a point where it becomes a job as opposed to the service and the honor that it is.
Right.
And you kind of lose some interest in actually changing things. When I started on the county board, there was a fellow there who I really liked, great guy, but he'd been there for 30-some years. And every time I'd talk to him about, you know, we should change this or this isn't right, the answer is, well, we fixed that back in 1987 that in 93, so it's good now.
Right.
And there are so many good people out there that want to serve and could serve and could try something different. I think we have a system that makes it really, really difficult for them to win if they're running against an incumbent. And the problem is bigger at the federal level. There's no way around that. But it is, I do believe it's a problem at the state level, and I think that the governor and the constitutional officers should all have term limits, and I think our legislators should as well. There's no magic number for me. I think, you know, 12 years seems reasonable. I don't think it should be 4 or 6 years because you do need some time to kind of learn what you're doing.
Right.
But I think giving someone 10, 12, maybe 14 years at the most is very reasonable. And, you know, when we have people who have been in there for 30 or 40 years, I don't think that's healthy.
Yeah, if you can't get it done in 14 years, then, I mean, you know, how much more time do you need? 2 decades, 3 decades?
Right.
It starts to get fairly unreasonable.
And honestly, then it just becomes your job.
Yes.
I could name several legislators who have moved their families multiple times so that when redistricting happened, they could stay in the legislature.
Ugh.
And that's just messed up when being in the legislature is more important than where your kids live and what school they go to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's a problem.
Yeah, definitely. If it's that high of a value. A lot of the other things you talk about would go some distance towards limiting the perceived value that motivates people to make such a ridiculous decision. You know, if it's not as sought after or as personally valuable to people to remain in the legislature, then they won't be making those kind of crazy decisions.
No, I think that's true.
So I'm interested in whether or not this term limit concept, if you have any ideas as to how to apply, you know, maybe not term limits as such, but a similar limitation to the bureaucratic state and the agencies and talk here about the bureaucrats' regulatory power in your action plan at johnsonforgovernor.org. What are your thoughts on kind of, because what you mentioned about the staleness that happens with public officials absolutely applies to the bureaucracy. Do you have any thoughts on what you would do about that?
You know, I've never thought of a term limit for bureaucrats, but that's a very interesting idea that I'm going to stick on a list now to kind of think through. more importantly for me with respect to the agencies, the DNR, the MPCA, the Department of Commerce, and go on down the list, is that we get aggressive about, I hate to use the term cleaning house because it sounds like I'm saying everybody in there is terrible, and that's right. Not true. But there are, in fact, there are a lot of great public employees. They really are, and they do good work. But there's also an element within every agency, and in some agencies it's a very large element, where they don't understand that their role is solely to serve people. They honestly believe that their job is to direct or control or bully in some cases or punish. And we need to root those people out of government. And I look at, the MPCA is a great example. The stories I hear almost on a daily basis from small business owners, from farmers who don't have they're not partisan at all. This is not a left-right thing to them. They might not even be political, but they've had just a terrible experience with a regulator at the MPCA who simply refuses to work with them or who kind of hides in the bushes and waits for them to make a mistake so they can pounce and fine them or punish them in another way. We need to get rid of those people. And, I mean, to me, within the bureaucracy, that is more important than any term limits would be, because if people understand their job is to serve and they actually are doing it, I'm okay with them being there for a longer period of time, because it is more of a job than being in the legislature. But all of these people who don't get that and refuse to buy into that, we need to remove them. And I'm an employment lawyer, a labor lawyer by profession. I haven't practiced in years, but that's my background. I know how unbelievably difficult that will be because of civil service rules and the fact that, you can't just fire somebody for political reasons, which is good. You shouldn't be able to. But because of the rules we have, you have to show cause, and then the union is going to challenge that, and you'll have an arbitration. We'll lose a lot of those cases if we say we're going to start cleaning house, but that's okay.
Right.
My instruction to my commissioners is to create a service organization, get rid of the people who refuse to abide by that, and if they come back, so be it. Just keep doing it, and eventually, over years, that culture will change.
One last issue, because we could talk at length about all these issues, and that would be a great time, but we're running short on that valuable commodity. That I want to hit before we let you go is education. And, you talk about the school finance system, and that's probably too complicated for us to dive into here. Suffice it to say, it needs simplifying. But another thing you mentioned here is giving parents a real choice in their children's education. What do you mean by that?
I mean, it might be vouchers. It might be through tax credits or there are a lot of different ways of doing it. But I truly believe in my perfect world, the money would follow the kid in every single instance, and parents would have an actual market to say, okay, we're going to take this tax money that we have paid in, and we're going to decide where to use that for our kids' education. That is obviously a sea change that's a long ways away. And so you got to start more realistically politically in Minnesota. And so for me, it's probably something on the line of vouchers or a tax credit or something like that, to start with parents who have kids in failing schools, however you define failing schools. Some of them are easy to define. And, if they're only graduating half their kids, or if year after year after year, a certain percentage are not even meeting basic skills, those schools are failing. Let's at least, as a starting point, give those parents options to take the money that they are paying in taxes and send their kid, use that money to send them to a different school, whether it's a private school or not. Give them the same options that a lot of us would have with our kids, because we could afford it.
Jeff Johnson, the website is johnsonforgovernor.org, all spelled out, johnsonforgovernor.org. Appreciate you coming on the program this evening, Jeff Johnson.
Thank you, Walter. Appreciate it.
Good luck this weekend.
Thanks.
Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. When we return, Jim Neuberger in studio to talk about his campaign to get the Republican endorsement to be the next U.S. Senator from Minnesota in place of Amy Klobuchar. 651-989-5855, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
waking up in the morning, gotta thank God. I don't know, but today seems kind of odd. No barking from the dog. No,
I have it on good authority that this is the official Jim Neuberger for U.S. Senate anthem. Just hit your red button there. The on button. There you go. I take your silence as an affirmative. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We're streaming on TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. In studio with us now, the aforementioned Jim Neuberger, seeking the Republican endorsement this weekend at the Republican Party of Minnesota Convention in Duluth for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Amy Klobuchar. And I actually had a moment there where I was like, which is it? Which is it? Which is it? But I remembered it's Amy Klobuchar, because we actually are in the very bizarre and highly unusual circumstance of having both of our U.S. Senate seats open this year.
Well, I think, Walter, the reason why you had a little bit of a brain pause there is because normally before you say Amy Klobuchar, you're supposed to cue the Darth Vader music.
Oh, I see. I got you. All right. So the first question I've been asking, because this is one of several, a series of interviews we've had this week leading up to the convention this weekend, and the first question out of the gate for everybody has been, can you give us an update on how the campaign's been going and what you're anticipating going into this crucial moment, which is the deciding of who the candidate's going to be for U.S. Senate against Amy Klobuchar?
Well, Walter, that's a great question, and thanks for bringing that up. I will say this. Our campaign is going really well. We started 10 months ago. I knew that it would take a lot of work. This is a big state, from corner to corner, north to south, east to west. It takes a long time and a lot of miles to get out there, and we've done that. Our campaign, we've been to every corner of the state. We've talked to, I've lost count of the events and the stops that we've made. We've had a really overwhelming, positive response to our message. And I wanted to make sure that we gave good time for that. This is something it's very difficult just to throw together. You don't just wake up one day and say, okay, in 3 months, I'm going to canvass the state and talk to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, some folks are able to do that, but those are the rare exceptions. Mm-hmm. The way that we've been doing it is the way we're going to carry it forward. We're just every day, we're going to keep pounding it out. And that's what we've done. Our campaign is going great. We've done really well in our straw polls over through the convention season. We're averaging in the high 70s, mid to high 70s for straw polls. But, you know, we take nothing for granted. There's no sure. The only sure thing, okay, the only sure thing in politics is that there is no sure thing.
Right.
But if you carry that thought forward too far, then you'll get crazy. So don't do that. But there is no sure thing until it's done. Mm-hmm. So we are going to, we're just going to keep running at 120 miles an hour. We're going to keep working hard from the minute we get up to the minute we go to bed. I've got an enormously energetic team. I've got folks that have been in the grassroots for, like yourself and myself, for years. Mm-hmm. And these are folks that we all know, love, and trust, and they're good friends, and it's just going really good.
That's good to hear. The last time that we got together and chatted, we got into a topic that I felt like we had to kind of cut off a little bit short, and that was the agency overreach. We kind of spoke about that a little bit with gubernatorial candidate Jeff Johnson here earlier in the program, the empowerment of the swamp, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a terminology coined by our President Donald Trump that has caught on, and probably because it's a fine metaphor in terms of the bog and the muck and the difficulty to traverse and navigate and what have you. Give us kind of an overview of what you see as potential. Well, first of all, the problems, and then some of the solutions to that issue.
Well, that's a great intro there, Walter. And you and I did start to touch on this the last time we spoke. This is such an enormous problem, not only on a state level, amplify that by a million. Okay, that's how big the problem is on the federal level. And what we have are these massive state agencies on the state level that operate independently. they do their own thing. And the word that you get in the hallways and in the meeting rooms where you're working through problems, the off conversations are always, you know, elected officials come and go.
Right.
But the agency will always be here. And right. If we've got a set of people that we've elected that seem to be contrarian to the agencies, if they're trying to undermine or do something against the agencies, what the agencies do is they're like turtles. They'll pull their heads and their tails and their feet in, and they'll just wait it out.
Right.
And they're very good at surviving. And what we need to do, Walter, not only on the state level, because this is why I'm running for a federal seat, because everything that happens in St. Paul, everything is almost a mere microcosm of what's happening on a grander scale in Washington, D.C. If you want to know how Washington, D.C. works, a good place to start is look at your state government, especially here in St. Paul and Minnesota. These state agencies have basically gone, in my opinion, completely amok. They've gone awry. They believe that they are the stabilizing force. They believe that they are the government.
Right.
And this has been something that's built up. I mean, a classic example, and this isn't even an agency per se, but you look at the Met Council. The Met Council, if you take every single state agency and set it aside and just look at the Met Council, right there, a study of that, an unelected body that has the authority to tax, that has the authority to bring citizens or private industry into court and sue them. This Met Council entity, unelected, which unilaterally can make decisions that really no one can challenge.
Right.
And their budget. Their budget in 2013 was over $1 billion. Over $1 billion, an unelected entity.
It's quite literally taxation without representation. You know, the people who are involved in the process of deciding what your taxes are going to be are not elected and therefore not representing you. And you might hear the argument on the other side, you know, those who support the status quo saying, well, yeah, but their authority was delegated to them by the legislature. But that's the problem, is exactly. The legislature giving up its authority to people who are not accountable to the people.
Exactly. And when you have, in Minnesota in particular, the DFL machine, if you look at the public sector unions who have huge, deep roots into these big agencies, and you look at where many of our DFL candidates are recruited from, there is this circular feeding cycle that goes on. And you don't have to scratch the surface very deep to find it. It's there. And when we look at the Met Council, now, the Met Council's original, to my knowledge, the original intent of the Met Council was more of a sewer authority. It was a water authority that said, you know, if you flush the toilet in Bloomington, it shouldn't wash up on the street in Richfield. They wanted to make sure that there was some continuity in the way that wastewater was handled and that water was handled. And at the time, there was a need for that because these independent communities weren't communicating with each other. And that's what the original premises of the Met Council was. Premise of the Met Council was. So if you look at what it has morphed into today.
Right.
So that's just a tiny glimpse of what we're facing here in Minnesota. And again, like I said, if you magnify that a million times, that's Washington, D.C. And if someone would have told me, Walter, in 2012, when I was first elected to the Minnesota House, Jim, you would be spending 70% of your time fighting state agencies on behalf of your constituents, I would not have believed it. I would have looked at you and I would have thought, well, maybe you're right, but we'll see. I would not have believed it. I'm telling you right now, as a three-term state representative, as vice chair of the Jobs and Energy Committee, I can look you right in the eye and tell you and all of our listeners out there that state agencies, their power is overwhelming, it's overreaching, and it's time to drain the swamp here in Minnesota.
We're going to talk about how Jim Neuberger plans to do that from the U.S. Senate. He's seeking the seat currently held by Amy Klobuchar, seeking the Republican endorsement for that race this weekend in Duluth at the Republican Party of Minnesota convention. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. We have in studio with us Jim Neuberger, seeking the Republican Party of Minnesota endorsement to run for U.S. Senate against Amy Klobuchar. Jim, you know, I've known you for quite some time. I consider you a friend. But there are some folks out there who might not be as familiar with you. Spend just a couple of minutes giving us your background, where you're coming from, where you've been, and what it is that makes you tick.
Well, what is it that makes me tick? That's a great question, Walter. I'm still trying to figure that one out. My wife could probably get you a better answer on that. I live in Becker, Minnesota. I was born and raised in St. Louis Park. I went to Hopkins Lindbergh at the time. I graduated from there. I then also went on and graduated from St. Cloud State in 1987. I have a degree in mass communications and political science, which lended really good to my next career, which was a paramedic. So I went to paramedic school.
Right.
After that, I worked full-time for 30 years. I just retired in April after 30 years of working for a level one trauma center right here in North Minneapolis. I worked there as a medic, and then I also served in the Minnesota House of Representatives for three terms. Mm-hmm. I am imposing my own term limits. Term limits are something I believe in, probably not like most people believe in, but I do believe in them, and I'll touch on that just first and briefly. But I'm stepping away from a very safe Republican seat because this has to be done. Someone has to challenge Senator Klobuchar. Someone has to take the fight to her. Someone has to be able to stand up and say enough is enough. Someone that really is able to carry this forward. Now, earlier I said I believe in term limits, and I do. I believe in term limits, and this goes right in context with what we're talking about with big agencies. Term limits, if you only have term limits for your elected officials, for your state representatives, for your senators, for your county commissioners, for your governors, whatever, name the elected office, you are going to shortchange, in my opinion, the power of the people because of the people that they elect into office. If you want to equalize that, if you really want to, in my opinion, take those steps to fix that stranglehold on government, then term limits must also apply to the leaders of the machine. If you are working in a department or an agency, or you are part of that fourth branch of government, that administrative branch, then those term limits have to apply to you and to lobbyists.
Your ears must have been tickling when I was talking to Jeff Johnson earlier in the program.
No, I was stuck in the elevator.
We were talking about this exact subject, and he was talking about his support for term limits, used the exact same terminology in terms of imposing it on himself when he was in the House, and you know how much he believes it for elected officials. Now, what you're saying is what I was suggesting to him, which was that it's not enough to just keep the elected officials under control in terms of how much power they have. You got to get to the root of the problem, which is these agencies.
It has to be the machine. And when I was at an energy conference in Colorado a few years back, because I'm the vice chair of the Energy Committee, Jobs and Energy Committee. And I was speaking with some of my counterparts, state representatives from other states that do have term limits. Their response to me was that they were okay with the term limits, but the problem that they faced and what immediately came to life was they said, you know, as soon as everyone is done, they either get a job with an agency or they become a lobbyist. And so they really don't lose their power.
Right.
They just shift positions where they're no longer elected. And by the way, they're making a lot more money.
Yeah. If anything, they become more powerful.
Exactly. So what happens is if you have a term limit that only applies to your elected officials, then there's going to be a power vacuum there, and high powered, long-term intelligent lobbyists or your department heads or your agency heads, these people are going to fill that gap because they're the ones that are going to have the institutional knowledge. So if you're going to have term limits, it's got to be crafted so it applies to the entire machine, not just your elected officials, because that's the only way you're going to fix it.
Yeah, there's a certain, and I don't know, I don't have the secret sauce answer to how you would implement something along these lines, but there's some biblical wisdom about, you know, kind of approaching the reset button every 7 to 14 years on things.
It's called Jubilee.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly right. You know exactly what I'm talking about. This idea that, you know, all things shall be made equal, you know, every 7-14 years, so that we can cleanse the system, so to speak, and start anew.
Yeah, try getting a mortgage in year six.
that's part of the regulatory process.
Exactly.
We talk so much in the public discourse about regulation, and regulation as a term has come to be synonymous with government rules. But real regulation is the regulation that people exhibit in the market when they actually have to live with the consequences of their decisions.
Exactly.
And the nice thing about that biblical concept of Jubilee is that, just as you say, as that year approached where everything was going to be reset, including the debts, you know, people were more reserved in terms of what they were willing to take on. Yeah, and that's healthy. That's a good thing. You should be cautious. You know, you could apply that to something like education, for instance. You know, how many decisions to send your kid to school, or as a student to take on a loan to go, you know, learn about women's studies or, you know, some sort of foo-foo degree, how many of those decisions are made only because of the government guarantee of student loans?
Funded by taxpayers.
Right.
Like you and me.
Exactly.
And all of our listening audience.
Yeah.
Well, getting back to our state agencies, our state agencies and our federal agencies are completely out of control, in my opinion. One very good example was just this biennium. We had the Department of Natural Resources, the DNR. I'm on the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And one of the things that we were able to do as a whole was approach the agencies and say, you must submit your budgets in line item form to the legislature for review before we vote on them. Because in years past, what would happen is these agencies would show up, they'd give you these pie charts, they were all very nebulous, and it was all just roses and beauty, and they would never get into the meat.
Mm-hmm.
We told them, hey, you got to come up with line item stuff.
Right.
The DNR refused until the very last day, hours before the deadline. They came into our chair's office, they threw a budget on his desk, and they walked out, and it was incomplete.
The arrogance of operating from the safety of the bureaucracy, that has to change. We're talking about draining the swamp with Jim Neuberger seeking the Republican endorsement to run for U.S. Senate. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hodson. We'll be back momentarily, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. If you're just tuning in, expecting to hear from Jim Neuberger, Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, challenging Amy Klobuchar. He's been here for half an hour. Came in early. Can't keep this guy down. It actually worked out really well because it timed out with the end of the Jeff Johnson interview, and we transitioned right over to you. We got your convention week interview blitz taking place here on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hodson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. And catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. Got a question, comment, other contribution for the show, 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Olin takes those calls and produces the show. So we've been talking quite a bit about what Donald Trump calls the swamp, and you've gone into detail regarding the bureaucracy, the different agencies. You've talked a lot from your experience as a state legislator observing state agencies and how they act. Perhaps it's overstating it to say outside the law, but certainly outside anything that resembles oversight.
Exactly.
From the citizenry and even from the legislature, they have this very defiant attitude towards elected officials and, through extension, the people who they represent, that's informed by this institutional knowledge that, well, I'll still be here after you are gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And we've talked about term limits and the idea that concept needs to apply to the bureaucracy as well. That's a pretty decent thumbnail sketch of your prescription for what to do about the swamp. Do you have any more thoughts or specific ideas of how you would go about actually draining this thing that we've been talking about since Donald Trump got elected?
Oh, boy, where do I start? Yes, I do, Walter. We ended this segment where I had made the comment. I had said, had somebody told me when I was first elected back in 2012 that I would spend the majority of my time fighting state agencies on behalf of my constituents, I don't think I would have entirely believed it. But it's true. I have spent the majority of my time in one way, shape, or form fighting a state agency. We are entering what I now call the rebellion season. So this is what happens, is when the legislature's in session, when the legislators are all down in St. Paul, the agencies tend to behave themselves. Mm-hmm. The minute we go sine die, or the minute we adjourn for the year, that's when they start creating rules. And rules carry the force of law. So then they impose these rules from May to January, or from May to March, and they make people's lives miserable. And then we come back into session, either in January or this year like we did in March. We come back into session, and we have to undo all of these rules. We have to pass laws to undo their rules. Repeat the cycles. That's what happens on the federal level as well. If you want a really good example of what's been happening on the federal level, you look at the DOJ, the Department of Justice. Look at many folks know our good friend Howard Root. Howard Root was a medical device entrepreneur.
Yep.
He was targeted by the Department of Justice. And it was basically, if you read his book, I'm not doing a plug for it, I'm just citing a reference. It's right. Called Cardiac Arrest. Mm-hmm. If you read his book, it's a very detailed outline on how the Department of Justice basically acted like gangster government.
Absolutely.
And Michelle Bachmann, former congresswoman, summed it up right. Gangster government is exactly what they are. They target people who have money, and they go after them, and they put you in a position where you either pay enormous, enormous fines in the millions of dollars, or you go to jail.
Right.
And it's extortion. And the Department of Justice is just one federal agency, Walter, that they fund their agency. Their agency funding comes through money that they make in settlements. So that there is a built-in incentive.
That's a conflict of interest.
There is a built-in incentive, exactly right, for them to persecute and prosecute citizens of the United States. Again, like I said, if you want to really dig into this particular slice of the swamp, you can reference Howard Root's book, Cardiac Arrest.
Sure.
I've heard him speak many times. He'd be a fascinating person also to interview on this subject. But suffice to say, as a United States senator, mm-hmm. I want to contrast myself with Senator Klobuchar. Senator Klobuchar has voted in compliance with the Barack Obama progressive left over 90% of her career. She has enabled the growth of government. She has enabled and facilitated, in my opinion, the massive overexpansion and overgrowth of these huge agencies that basically squish the life out of people. She needs to answer for that, because agencies, there is a place for agencies, okay? The state agencies, they're not the third level of purgatory, okay? Like, they aren't. There is a place for them, but the perspective is completely askew. Agencies were created to serve people, and what we have are people serving agencies.
Right.
And that's been completely turned on its head, and it's especially oppressive on the federal level. Now, as a United States senator, I would have enormous leverage over these agencies. And I've learned how to do this on the state level, and I hate to admit it, but it's kind of my forte. Sometimes you have a sense of purpose, mm-hmm. and this is one of those that I think that I've really picked up on. As a U.S. senator, I would be sitting on subcommittees and committees that have oversight over the budgets of these committees. Now, true, all spending bills have to originate in the House.
Right.
But they also have to be approved by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple. The power of the purse to vote in favor of a budgetary expenditure for an agency or for a specific program. If they're not behaving, you don't give them money.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that simple. And if they're not behaving, if they are creating rules that are squeezing the life out of our people, then you write law to undo their rules. It's an ongoing battle. But at the end of the day, you have to keep pulling the plug, and you have to keep draining the swamp, because sooner or later you're going to win. But you're not going to win if you don't stop. You have to keep up the pressure. And we are talking about generations of slow, what I call a slow culture shift within the D.C. swamp. And just like we've seen here in St. Paul, you have people that are elected that create the laws. You have the agencies that carry out the directives to make all of it work. But they create these rules that carry the force of law. And now there's just been this shift, this incredible shift that really has to stop because it's like an avalanche. It's just like an avalanche, either on the state level or the federal level.
As I listen to you talk about it, it occurs to me, and this is right off the cuff, as I'm thinking it, I'm saying it, which is never a good idea.
Especially if you're married.
As I'm thinking it, I'm saying it. So I have not vetted this, but it occurs to me that there may be a need for a constitutional amendment to prevent exactly this type of, you know, they call it delegation of authority, but it's really dereliction of duty. It's the insult. The reason why legislators, present company excluded, tend to give agencies in the bureaucracy all this power is because they are then insulated from the political fallout. You empower people to make decisions that you wouldn't be able to because your people who you represent would be upset with you if you did.
The other problem that we have is we have lost our basic focus when it comes to the premise of our government. Show me in our Constitution, whether it's state or federal, where agencies have enumerated powers.
Right.
They do not have enumerated powers. The overreach and the exercise of these agencies is so unconstitutional. Yeah. So going back to one of my solutions, who says we have to have these agencies? Mm. Who says we have to have a Department of Justice? Who says we have to have a Department of fill in the blank? Mm. Okay. What is wrong with going back to the concept that you had brought up, the year of Jubilee, where you come up and you say, okay, this state agent or this federal agency, this is the year you're done. You are eliminated in 3 years. You're done.
Right.
We're going to eliminate you.
Right.
You're gone.
Yeah.
And then we're going to have a series of bills to figure out what we need to do to replace you. And it's going to be smaller, leaner, and meaner. And not meaner as demeanor.
Right.
But
yeah.
It'll be more effective. It'll be more effective than what we currently have. You drain the swamp, and then you start over. You start smaller. You start smarter.
Right. Let's talk to Bob in Woodbury. You're on with Jim Neuberger seeking the Republican endorsement for U.S. Senate.
Hey, Bob.
I was just a comment on this deep state concept. A milder version, but a very real version of it. I worked with some Minnesota state people. It's been 15, 20 years ago. And they were explaining that if a new governor comes in, they've got this great idea how they want to do something. And if these state employees don't really agree with it, one strategy that they take, and this is one of the manager type people, workers there, is that their strategy is they'll just wait them out. They'll drag their feet. They'll take it slow, and eventually, the guy's out of office, and whatever this great idea was doesn't happen because they've basically kind of blocked and stalled it. That's not anything deep or nefarious, but it is an example of where unelected people with a particular agenda or way of looking at the world go contrary to what the elected officials, right and intent is to, try to manage things a certain way.
Appreciate your comment, Bob. Yeah, it is nefarious in the sense that it's, and you hit it on the nail when you said it was unconstitutional. The notion that the Constitution did not grant legislative authority, did not enumerate powers to these agencies. And, I brought up the idea of a constitutional amendment, but in a sane world, you wouldn't need one because in a sane world, it would be inherent. It would be implicit in the fact that the power lies with the legislature. What's the point of getting elected to office if all you're going to do with the power you've been cloaked with is hand it to somebody else?
And Ronald Reagan, he's got so many great quotes, but one thing Ronald Reagan said is that the closest thing you'll ever see to eternal life in this world is a government program.
Right.
And he was right. I mean, all kidding aside, he was right. And Bob also, our caller, he had hit it on the head as well. What they do is these agencies, whether you're federal or they're state, they've got so many different pockets of money. They've got so many different places where they put their money away, and they shift it around. And all they have to do is tighten up their belts a little bit, and they wait it out. They wait till the reformers are gone. And then they bring money that they want. They hide it. They'll bring it back out into the light to keep moving and advancing their agenda. And these agendas are driven by, what I've seen happen is by the far extreme progressive left. There has been a movement amongst agency leadership, especially in the state of Minnesota and on the federal level. If you were to sit down and look at where the majority of these agency leadership people, where they fall on their ideological scale, they are extreme left. And these are people that are appointed, most of which were appointed by the Barack Obama administration. And if you look at the Donald Trump administration, as he has tried to replace a lot of these leaders on the federal level, the Senate has to confirm much of this. Senator Klobuchar is one of the most obstructionist voters that we have in the Senate.
Let's dig into that when we return. Her obstructionist voting record and other sins committed by Amy Klobuchar. Jim Neuberger in studio with us, seeking the Republican endorsement for U.S. Senate to run against the aforementioned Amy Klobuchar. Closing argument. My name is Walter Otson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Republican delegates and activists will gather in Duluth this weekend to decide who among a number of candidates ought to be endorsed for various offices. We have gubernatorial candidates. We have candidates seeking two open U.S. Senate seats. One of them is in studio with us now, Jim Neuberger, seeking to challenge Amy Klobuchar. First, he's got to get through the convention this weekend and secure delegate endorsement. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. When we asked you earlier to give us your background, you mentioned that you've worked as a paramedic. We were just talking about that a little bit off the air. I'm curious as to, because, you know, I've had other friends who have worked as medics and have worked in emergency services. I myself went through training to be an EMT and what have you. And I've been exposed to the mentality, and it is a different mentality. It's a different view of the world when you're out there and you're seeing people, you know, in their having their worst day, right? You're seeing people having their worst day on a daily basis. It has an effect upon your own values and how you see the world. How, if at all, has that colored your approach to public service and informed what you're doing with your campaign for U.S. Senate?
Well, that's a great question, Walter. I would have to say that my 30 years as a full-time medic in the north side of Minneapolis and western Hennepin County has really been, I count it as a blessing. I retired this year in April, and I will miss the people. I really do. But after 30 years, that was enough. 30 years is good for whatever you do. And I will also miss having very critical patients. And the reason why I miss that, whether they're sick with a disease or if it's trauma or whatever the problem is, and the reason why I miss that is because those are the patients you can give the most care to. You can really see, you are really making a difference. I mean, it's a very, to be able to walk into a situation or a car crash where someone is really in a bad way and to bring relief to that person, it's a reward that transcends money. I mean, it is something that I will always value as long as I live, being able to do that for people. But as far as how this has tempered me for public service, especially in this race against Senator Klobuchar, when I first got into this back in August, people said, "What are you nuts? You know, you can't win this race. Nobody wants to run in this race." Well, if you look at the polling data, things are starting to change, and things drastically changed after Al Franken had his issues, which, by the way, Senator Klobuchar she still backs up Al Franken, our senator for women.
Right.
But this whole, how do I put it? As a medic, I never had the opportunity to say no. No matter what I was called to, I had to do my job.
Mm.
No matter, you couldn't walk into a situation and say, nope, this is too
bad.
Yeah,
I'm passing on this.
This is too, you do not have that option.
Right. Yeah.
Your job is to make, is to take an impossible situation and try to turn it around and to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at this, this Klobuchar race is no different. I look at this as a medic and I say, you know what? There's an issue. There is a problem. This is something that everyone else is saying no to. You know what? I'm not saying no to this because it's my job. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You become wired to really approach impossible situations with that mentality. And you know what? It works.
I had an instinct that that question was going to draw out something unique from you, and I'm glad I asked it, because that was a pretty fantastic insight. It's a great way to view not just this task, but any difficult task, is that it needs to be done. I'm the one who's here, so I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's exactly how I view it. And I love public service. I love being able to help people. I'm 54 years old, and in the conversation we're having while we were off the air during the break, I had mentioned to you, I'm not in this for money. I'm not in this to get a position of for money, because if I wanted to make a lot of money in my life, I would have done something. I wouldn't have been right. A paramedic. I can tell you that right now. I'm in this, this whole concept of public service. This is for me, it's a path that's been put before me. I'm a person of faith. And I believe that you walk the path, regardless of what it is in life, you walk the path that's been put in front of you.
Hmm.
And this is the path that has been put in front of me. And win, lose, or draw, I'm going to walk this path. I'm not going to walk this path. I'm going to run this path. I'm going to give it 150% of everything that I have. And I'm going to have that medic mentality. Here's an impossible situation that some people think is impossible. Get the job done. And that's what I'm going to do.
So let's contrast that with the current occupant of the office. We've kind of skirted around it a little bit as we've been talking here over the past hour. Amy Klobuchar has been, well, physically there. There isn't a whole lot more you can say about her that is particularly positive. She has this air of, you know, you talked about people saying you're crazy to run against her. I think the reason for that perception is because she has this air of niceness that everybody seems to buy into.
Just don't take a deep breath.
So talk a little bit about your general election opponent and what it is about her that, and you've already kind of laid down a couple of the points, but in a little bit of a broader scope of why Amy Klobuchar needs to end her career in the U.S.
Well, I want to go right after that whole persona of being nice, and I've said this for the last 10 months, is that Amy Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar, I still need to be respectful, regardless, and I will respect that. Senator Klobuchar, she does what I call is she's the master of the Washington two-step dance. She'll come home, she'll promise the world, she'll smile for the camera, she'll hold up a hot dish. She'll pat the dog, you know, and hug the kids and get that photo out there in the cornfield. And then she'll run back to Washington, D.C. and then keep voting over 90% with the extreme progressive left.
Mm-hmm.
And throw over half our state's population under the bus every time she does that. Her persona of being nice is really starting to fracture, especially around the edges. Politico is an online presence. It's a media outlet. Every year they do a survey of the most toxic people to work for in Washington, D.C., and they do it with legitimate numbers. It's by staff turnover. How many people just can't work for you? How many people quit? Guess who was ranked as the number one most toxic person, elected person in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it'd be really strange if the answer was anyone other than Amy Klobuchar.
Well, you just won the prize. There we go. And maybe, you know, as a person to her family, and to her friends,
sure.
I'm not going to demean her in that way.
Right.
But as a boss, that's just what the numbers show.
Mm-hmm.
Folks in Minnesota are smarter than most people think around the country. And we see through that. As I've been, like I said earlier in the show, as we've been traveling around the entire state, every corner of the state I've been in, talking to people, that's one of the things that keeps coming up, Walter. It's like, you know, we like Amy, but she doesn't seem to be as nice as she lets on. And then they'll start talking about some of the issues.
Right.
One of the big issues that I covered recently was the nation state of Israel celebrated its 70th birthday. I went to some of the events. It was she was supposed to be there. She didn't show. She might have. I'm not going to cast an aspersion on that because I understand she's busy. She might have had a schedule conflict. But as I was speaking with friends from the Israeli Jewish community, they've had it. They've had it with her. She's supposed to be a friend of Israel, and that's how she has positioned herself for a very long time. But yet she supported Barack Obama's program to help the nation of Iran develop a nuclear program, a nation that has said that their stated number one primary goal is to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And yet,
doesn't sound very nice.
No, it doesn't. And when Senator Klobuchar supported this Obama plan to enable Iran to develop a nuclear program, mm-hmm. that sent a shockwave of reality through the Jewish community that, hey, wait a second. What's more important?
Yeah.
What's more important? The nation of Israel, who has been our best friend and ally in the Middle East since its inception, or these renegade rogue states that sponsor terrorism? Barack Obama was wrong to enter into this deal, and I'm so glad that President Trump just basically said, forget it. He just cut that off. I mean, kudos to President Trump, and I will never stop praising him for that one. But the Jewish Israeli population, especially those here in Minnesota, they took notice of that, and they haven't forgotten, because most of them have friends and family members who live in Israel. Mm-hmm. And this was a golden opportunity for Senator Klobuchar to stand up for our best friend and closest ally in the Middle East, and she threw him under the bus.
Right.
So that's just one glaring example.
Jim Neuberger, we've had in studio with us for the past hour. It's been great having you on, as usual.
It has.
And it always seems like we run out of time and have so much more left to say. People can catch up with you in Duluth this weekend. You're seeking the Republican endorsement at the state convention of the Republican Party of Minnesota. Your website, Quick.
Jim4, that's F-O-R, Jim4, USSenate.com.
There you go. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hatson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. A seven nation army couldn't hold me back. They're gonna rip it off, taking their time right behind my back. And I'm talking to myself at night because I can't forget. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hatson. We're streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights. It's great having you with us. 651-989-5855 is the number to join the conversation. Brad Omland takes those calls and produces the show. You know, these were great interviews. I really enjoyed giving them. I enjoyed the conversation that this week. I didn't know how this was going to go. I've never really made as strong of an effort as I have this week to have on this many guests. And I'm actually kind of impressed by the response that I got from all these invitations. In fact, tomorrow we're going to have, and Brad's learning this for the first time too, I just realized, Mary Giuliani Steffens, which is going to complete the trifecta of gubernatorial candidates, excluding Tim Pawlenty, who, you know, given the fact that we're talking about the convention week blitz and he's not going to the convention, I regard that as a hat trick. I regard that as a completion of the collection, so to speak.
You're not going
to
have Lance Johnson on?
Because I put out this Facebook message over the weekend asking, hey, is there anybody else that I don't know about? And somebody mentioned Lance Johnson. Never heard of him before that comment on my Facebook thread, and haven't heard anything since either. So, look, you know, equal time. The guy wants to come on. We'll talk to him. Tomorrow after 10 is looking good. Friday's wide open if you want to come on the program. Although I think if you're making a serious effort at the endorsement, you'll probably be out of town on Friday. So there is that. But I've been really impressed. You know, we had Karen Housley last night, seeking the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Tina Smith. We just got done talking with Jim Neuberger, who's looking to fill Amy Klobuchar's seat. And we talked with Jeff Johnson earlier today regarding his gubernatorial bid. And in all three of those cases, you have individuals who understand what needs to be done and who sincerely believe in the principles that we talk about here on this program on a day-to-day basis. And I guess the only question remains is, can they win? And that's a legitimate question, is can they win? Because it seems as though, you know, we talked about the kind of divide within the Republican Party between the quote-unquote establishment and the quote-unquote grassroots. I put quotes around both of those terms because even though I've used those terms, I think they're often used, they're often misused to destructive effect and too broadly categorize things which ought to be viewed with some degree of nuance. Yeah, I don't think there's a good guy and a bad guy, a white hat and a black hat in this conversation over the merits of the convention process and the endorsement, you know, and talking about Tim Pawlenty, and the merits of a primary and the different forces that are engaged in pulling the party in one direction or the other on that question. There are merits to both sides of that argument because, one, the convention process, I believe, is very well tuned to selecting the best candidate for the job, meaning the person who would perform best if actually elected. But historically, within the Republican Party of Minnesota, the process has not been terribly good statewide at selecting candidates who will win, which, of course, is, you know, kind of a big deal. You know, we're going to be talking after the convention has concluded the Wednesday after, I believe on the 2nd, we're going to have Kip and Max in from the Kip and Max Save the World podcast. And I just started checking that out after hearing from a lot of people that it was essential analysis. And indeed, it's very provocative. So it'll be a lot of fun to talk with them because, you know, they take on this concept in at least one of their episodes that I listened to, the idea that conservatives, their basic thesis is that conservatives need to, in order for their principles to be effective, they need to elect people or nominate people, endorse people who will win. Because you can have the most principled person in the world who believes all the right things and would be a great administrator, be great in the job, but if they can't get elected, then those principles are not effective in the sense of actually, you know, the rubber meeting the road in terms of public policy and governance. And that is a legitimate point. But the question that I have for them, and, you know, just to tease it out, when we eventually talk with them after the convention, is at what point does the trade-off between principle and electability result in something that's not even worth having in the first place?
Well, my question is, what is electability?
How do you mean?
What is it? What makes a candidate electable?
I thought that was a rhetorical question. No. You actually had.
No. What is electability? What makes a candidate electable? I guess I would pose it, just don't be boring.
Hmm.
Because that's the Republican Party's biggest, Minnesota specifically, the Minnesota Republican Party is boring.
Hmm.
There's no value proposition. There still is, and I've heard all the candidates on this radio show, and I'm still not convinced by any of them that I should go out and vote for them. It's so boring.
Hmm. Yeah, I cannot, I'm not fired up to argue against you. And with all apology.
See, there you go.
With all apology to those who we've had on. And look, you know, many of whom, including Jim Neuberger, who was just in here, Jeff Johnson, who we talked to on the phone earlier today, I regard as personal friends. I've known for years. I know they believe the right things. I know they would go in there and do their best to affect principles to the best of their ability. There is and in the era of Trump, this is definitely something that we have had demonstrated to us. There's a production value that needs to be brought to fore in terms of when you're going out and talking to people outside of this space, right? Like this audience, you know, talking to me, talking to you, talking to the people who listen to this show is one thing. You know, sitting here talking about agencies for half an hour is completely acceptable and actually interesting to folks. But outside of that scope, you're not going to create a campaign ad based upon, you know, we're going to go after the agencies, right? So how do you sell the message? And that's another thing that I am eager to talk to Kip and Max about, because they've kind of hinted at some interesting ideas on this idea, is the value proposition, as you put it, of libertarian ideas. When you're putting yourself out there as a candidate or as a party, and your fundamental premise is there should be less of what I'm running for, right? Like I'm running to be elected to do less of what you're getting from the guy who's there now. That's intuitively a difficult value proposition to sell to people because nobody wants less, right? Like when you go out into the market and you're looking at products and services, you're not looking for less. When somebody's running a sale at their store or the department store or whatever the case may be, you don't see signs peppered all over the inventory saying get less now, right? It's always get more, get bigger. You know, if anything's less, it's the price, higher value, lower cost. And even though that it's not a apples to apples metaphor, rhetorically, there's this connection in people's mind that more is better and less is bad. And so when the value proposition from libertarians and libertarian leaning conservatives is we're going to give you less government, unless you're already on that train, unless you're already somebody who is an activist within the right wing space, you're going to have an inherent instinctive reaction to that that is to some degree like icky, like, oh, I don't know if I like the idea of getting less. Shouldn't I be voting for somebody who's going to give me more? And so how do you sell these ideas in an effective way that makes people feel like they're actually getting something for getting behind you?
Well, we've undersold the value of freedom.
There you go. And you need to be my answer to get ahead of the discussion we'll eventually have with Kip and Max is that it really does come to selling the result, not selling the process, not selling that this is what I'm going to do when I get into office, but here's how life is going to be better as a result of what you do once you get to office. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. An example of how we could sell a better life as a result of implementing libertarian / conservative policies in government can be found in considering the potential of an education system that's decoupled from the state. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Got a little bit of time left to squeeze in your contribution to the program this evening. Ron Paul had a good post on Facebook yesterday. This is what he had to say. Ever notice how government schools are modeled after a factory? They even look like factories. This was done on purpose, of course. Laws were then created to force everyone into these factories during their most impressionable years. Former communist leader Vladimir Lenin, responsible for 4 million deaths, once said, "Give us the child for 8 years and it will be a Bolshevik forever." Compulsory education is the crown jewel of government control. After 18 years in the factory, they're quite confident that you won't think outside of how you've been taught to think. You'll be too afraid to. Fortunately, modern communication technologies are not only taking down government's other propaganda tool, the mainstream media, but they're also enabling people to get their kids out of the government's education grip. And then he goes on to pitch the Ron Paul curriculum, which is apparently a homeschooling curriculum that's available from the former congressman. And there's an interesting meme that's attached to this post. It's an old-timey picture of a classroom. And the question is, what does school really teach children? Well, it teaches them that truth comes from authority, that intelligence is the ability to remember and repeat, that inaccurate memory and repetition are to be rewarded, that noncompliance is to be punished, and that you should conform intellectually and socially. So that's the status quo. And so, you know, when you try to sell an alternative to this, modeled off of what Brad and I were talking about in the last segment, you don't necessarily start off with, well, we're going to go in there and we're going to have less funding for education, right? Because that's how it's going to be going to be criticized as, well, you're taking away kids' education. No. Skip to the effect of the policy. The effect of a privatized education system where individual parents are seeking the highest value for their students at the lowest cost. The effect of that is going to be a child that is properly conditioned to negotiate reality and to conceive of and pursue their own values, to pursue happiness. That's something that's invaluable. That's something that's priceless. You know, when I think back upon my transition from being a high school student to being a quote-unquote grown-up, it was a hard shift. It was a hard shift for me in particular because I didn't have, you know, I had a mom and a dad, but they weren't particularly well-equipped to mentor me or to direct me in any, you know, particularly productive direction. And so I just found myself in a situation where it very much felt like, after having been told exactly what I'm supposed to do for most of the day, for the time I get up until, you know, I'm done with school, till the time I go to bed, after having my life laid out for me, a schedule handed to me, here's the classroom you need to be to, here's your locker number, here's the combination, here are the books you need to buy, you know, here's where you need to carry them, here's when you need to be on the bus, having everything lined up in an institutional itinerary, all of a sudden you graduate high school and boop, you're just dropped into life. And the first question on my mind was, what do I do now? Who's going to show up to tell me what to do next? And the answer was no one, which is it's a horrific, and you know, other people potentially, hopefully, are blessed to have a less difficult transition because they have people who are mentoring them and helping them out and, you know, giving them some ideas of what they could do next and what have you. But for me, it was a hard shift. And it would have been less so had the educational process, the educational system, been intended and developed around the idea of getting me to the point where I could conceive of and pursue autonomously, independently, my own values. Isn't that what education should be for? And by selling that, by asking that question, it puts the opposition, it puts the other side, it puts the left in the position of having to argue, no, it shouldn't. No, you shouldn't be independent. No, you shouldn't be autonomous. No, you shouldn't conceive of and pursue your own values. No, you shouldn't be going after your own happiness. Let them make that argument. Approach it from that angle. Not the, you know, we're looking to take something from you, but something has already been taken from you and we're looking to give it back. We're looking to give back an outlook on life that has unlimited potential, where you can be the most that you are capable of being without restraint, without confinement, without being hindered by a state that does not care about you as an individual, cares only about the perpetuation of its own power, its own influence, and its own lockdown on the culture. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 9 to 11 weeknights. Glenn Beck is next, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.